fire. "It is a sin to burn this," she would say, "when so many people do not even have enough to eat." And so the burning was postponed. It was always postponed. And things were only shifted from their places of privilege to the stables that had been transformed into storage bins for remnants, while the spaces that had been cleared, just as he predicted, began to fill up again, to overflow with things that lived for a moment and then went to die in the closets, until the next time. She would say, "Someone should invent something to do with things you cannot use anymore but that you still cannot throw out." That was true. She was dismayed by the voracity with which objects kept invading living spaces, displacing the humans, forcing them back into the corners, until Fermina Daza pushed the objects out of sight. For she was not as ordered as people thought, but she did have her own desperate method for appearing to be so. She hid the disorder. The day that Juvenal Urbino died, they had to empty out half of his study and pile the things in the bedrooms so there would be space to lay out the body. Death's passage through the house brought the solution. Once she had burned her husband's clothes, Fermina Daza realized that her hand had not trembled. And on the same impulse, she continued to light the fire at regular intervals, throwing everything on it, old and new, not thinking about the envy of the rich or the vengeance of the poor who were dying of hunger. Finally, she had the mango tree cut back at the roots until there was nothing left of that misfortune, and she gave the live parrot to the new museum of the city. Only then did she draw a free breath in the kind of house she had always dreamed of. Large, easy, and all hers. Her daughter Ophelia spent 3 months with her and then returned to New Orleans. Her son brought his family to lunch on Sundays and as often as he could during the week. Fermina Daza's closest friends began to visit her once she had overcome the crisis of her mourning. They played cards facing the bare patio. They tried out new recipes. They brought her up to date on the secret life of the insatiable world that continued to exist without her. One of the most faithful was Lucrecia del Real del Obispo, an aristocrat of the old school who had always been a good friend and who drew even closer after the death of Juvenal Urbino. Stiff with arthritis and repenting her wayward life, in those days, Lucrecia del Real not only provided her with the best company, she also consulted with her regarding the civic and secular projects that were being arranged in the city. And this made her feel useful for her own sake, and not because of the protective shadow of her husband. And yet she was never so closely identified with him as she was then, for she was no longer called by her maiden name, and she became known as the Widow Urbino. It seemed incredible, but as the first anniversary of her husband's death approached, Fermina Daza felt herself entering a place that was shady, cool, quiet. The Grove of the Irremediable. She was not yet aware, and would not be for several months, of how much the written meditations of Florentino Ariza had helped her to recover her peace of mind. Applied to her own experiences, they were what allowed her to understand her own life and to await the designs of old age with serenity. Their meeting at the Memorial Mass was a providential opportunity for her to let Florentino Ariza know that she too, thanks to his letters of encouragement, was prepared to erase the past. 2 days later, she received a different kind of letter from him, handwritten on linen paper and his complete name inscribed with great clarity on the back of the envelope. It was the same ornate handwriting as in his earlier letters, the same will to lyricism, but applied to a simple paragraph of gratitude for the courtesy of her greeting in the cathedral. For several days after she read the letter, Fermina Daza continued to think about it with troubled memories, but with a conscience so clear that on the following Thursday, she suddenly asked Lucrecia del Real del Obispo if she happened to know Florentino Ariza, the owner of the riverboats. Lucrecia replied that she did. He seems to be a wandering succubus. She repeated the common gossip that he had never had a woman, although he was such a good catch, and that he had a secret office where he took the boys he pursued at night along the docks. Fermina Daza had heard that story for as long as she could remember, and she had never believed it or given it any importance. But when she heard it repeated with so much conviction by Lucrecia del Real del Obispo, who had also been rumored at one time to have strange tastes, she could not resist the urge to clarify matters. She said she had known Florentino Arisa since he was a boy. She reminded her that his mother had owned a notion shop on the Street of Windows and also bought old shirts and sheets, which she unraveled and sold as bandages during the Civil Wars. And she concluded with conviction, "He is an honorable man, and he is the soul of tact." She was so vehement that Lucrecia took back what she had said. "When all is said and done, they also say the same sort of thing about me." Fermina Daza was not curious enough to ask herself why she was making so passionate a defense of a man who had been no more than a shadow in her life. She continued to think about him, above all when the mail arrived without another letter from him. 2 weeks of silence had gone by when one of the servant girls woke her during her siesta with a warning whisper.
"Señora," she said, "Don Florentino is here."
He was there. Fermina Daza's first reaction was panic. She thought, no, he should come back another day at a more appropriate hour. She was in no condition to receive visitors. There was nothing to talk about. But she recovered instantly and told her to show him into the drawing room and bring him coffee, while she tidied herself before seeing him. Florentino Arisa had waited at the street door, burning under the infernal 3 o'clock sun, but in full control of the situation. He was prepared not to be received, even with an amiable excuse, and that certainty kept him calm. But the decisiveness of her message shook him to his very marrow, and when he walked into the cool shadows of the drawing room, he did not have time to think about the miracle he was experiencing, because his intestines suddenly filled in an explosion of painful foam. He sat down, holding his breath, hounded by the damnable memory of the bird droppings on his first love letter, and he remained motionless in the shadowy darkness until the first attack of shivering had passed, resolved to accept any mishap at that moment except this unjust misfortune. He knew himself well. Despite his congenital constipation, his belly had betrayed him in public 3 or 4 times in the course of his many years, and those 3 or 4 times he had been obliged to give in. Only on those occasions, and on others of equal urgency, did he realize the truth of the words that he liked to repeat in jest. "I do not believe in God, but I am afraid of him." He did not have time for doubts. He tried to say any prayer he could remember, but he could not think of a single one. When he was a boy, another boy had taught him magic words for hitting a bird with a stone. "Aim, aim, got my aim. If I miss you, I'm not to blame." He used it when he went to the country for the first time with a new slingshot, and the bird fell down dead. In a confused way, he thought that one thing had something to do with the other, and he repeated the formula now with the fervor of a prayer, but it did not have the desired effect. A twisting in his guts, like the coil of a spring, lifted him from his seat. The foaming in his belly grew thicker and more painful. It grumbled a lament and left him covered with icy sweat. The maid who brought him the coffee was frightened by his corpse's face. He sighed, "It's the heat." She opened the window, thinking she would make him more comfortable, but the afternoon sun hit him full in the face and she had to close it again. He knew he could not hold out another moment, and then Fermina Daza came in, almost invisible in the darkness, dismayed at seeing him in such a state.
"You can take off your jacket," she said to him.
He suffered less from the deadly griping of his bowels than from the thought that she might hear them bubbling, but he managed to endure just an instant longer to say no. He had only passed by to ask her when he might visit.
still standing, she said to him in confusion, "Well, you are here now." And she invited him to the terrace in the patio, where it was cooler. He refused in a voice that seemed to her like a sigh of sorrow. "I beg you, let it be tomorrow," he said. She remembered that tomorrow was Thursday, the day when Lucrecia del Real del Obispo made her regular visit, but she had the perfect solution. The day after tomorrow at 5 o'clock. Florentino Ariza thanked her, bid an urgent farewell with his hat, and left without tasting the coffee. She stood in the middle of the drawing room, puzzled, not understanding what had just happened, until the sound of his automobile's backfiring faded at the end of the street. Then Florentino Ariza shifted into a less painful position in the back seat, closed his eyes, relaxed his muscles, and surrendered to the will of his body. It was like being reborn. The driver, who after so many years in his service was no longer surprised at anything, remained impassive. But when he opened the door for him in front of his house, he said, "Be careful, Don Floro. That looks like cholera." But it was only his usual ailment. Florentino Ariza thanked God for that on Friday at 5 o'clock sharp, when the maid led him through the darkness of the drawing room to the terrace in the patio, where he saw Fermina Daza sitting beside a small table set for two. She offered him tea, chocolate, or coffee. Florentino Ariza asked for coffee, very hot and very strong, and she told the maid, "The usual for me." The usual was a strong infusion of different kinds of Oriental teas, which raised her spirits after her siesta. By the time she had emptied the teapot and he the coffee pot, they had both attempted and then broken off several topics of conversation, not so much because they were really interested in them, but in order to avoid others that neither dared to broach. They were both intimidated. They could not understand what they were doing so far from their youth, on a terrace with checkerboard tiles, in a house that belonged to no one, and that was still redolent of cemetery flowers. It was the first time in half a century that they had been so close, and had enough time to look at each other with some serenity. And they had seen each other for what they were. Two old people, ambushed by death, who had nothing in common except the memory of an ephemeral past that was no longer theirs, but belonged to two young people who had vanished and who could have been their grandchildren. She thought that he would at last be convinced of the unreality of his dream, and that this would redeem his insolence. In order to avoid uncomfortable silences or undesirable subjects, she asked obvious questions about riverboats. It seemed incredible that he, the owner, had only traveled the river once, many years ago, before he had anything to do with the company. She did not know his reasons, and he would have been willing to sell his soul if he could have told them to her. She did not know the river either. Her husband had an aversion to the air of the Andes that he concealed with a variety of excuses. The dangers to the heart of the altitude, the risks of pneumonia, the duplicity of the people, the injustices of centralism. And so they knew half the world, but they did not know their own country. Nowadays there was a Junkers seaplane that flew from town to town along the basin of the Magdalena like an aluminum grasshopper, with two crew members, six passengers, and many sacks of mail. Florentino Ariza commented, "It is like a flying coffin." She had been on the first balloon flight, and had experienced no fear, but she could hardly believe that she was the same person who had dared such an adventure. She said, "Things have changed." Meaning that she was the one who had changed, and not the means of transportation. At times the sound of airplanes took her by surprise. She had seen them flying very low and performing acrobatic maneuvers on the centenary of the death of the Liberator. One of them, as black as an enormous turkey buzzard, grazed the roofs of the houses in La Manga, left a piece of wing in a nearby tree, and was caught in the electrical wires. But not even that had convinced Vedmina Dasa of the existence of airplanes. In recent years, she had not even had the curiosity to go to Manzanillo Bay, where seaplanes landed on the water after the police launches had warned away the fishermen's canoes and the growing number of recreational boats. Because of her age, she had been chosen to greet Charles Lindbergh with a bouquet of roses when he came here on his goodwill flight, and she could not understand how a man who was so tall, so blonde, so handsome, could go up in a contraption that looked as if it were made of corrugated tin, and the two mechanics had to push by the tail to help lift it off the ground. She just could not get it through her head that airplanes, not much larger than that one, could carry 8 people. On the other hand, she had heard that the river boats were a delight, because they did not roll like ocean liners, although there were other, more serious dangers, such as sandbars and attacks by bandits. Florentino Ariza explained that those were all legends from another time. These days, the riverboats had ballrooms and cabins, as spacious and luxurious as hotel rooms, with private baths and electric fans, and there had been no armed attacks since the last Civil War. He also explained, with the satisfaction of a personal triumph, that these advances were due more than anything else to the freedom of navigation that he had fought for and which had stimulated competition. Instead of a single company, as in the past, there were now 3, which were very active and prosperous. Nevertheless, the rapid progress of aviation was a real threat to all of them. She tried to console him. Boats would always exist because there were not many people crazy enough to get into a contraption that seemed to go against nature. Then Florentino Ariza spoke of improvements in mail service, transportation, as well as delivery, in an effort to have her talk about his letters. But he was not successful. Soon afterward, however, the occasion arose on its own. They had moved far afield of the subject when a maid interrupted them to hand Fermina Dasa a letter that had just arrived by special urban mail, a recent creation that used the same method of distribution as telegrams. As always, she could not find her reading glasses. Florentino Ariza remained calm. "That will not be necessary," he said. "The letter is mine." And so it was. He had written it the day before, in a terrible state of depression because he could not overcome the embarrassment of his first frustrated visit. In it, he begged her pardon for the impertinence of attempting to visit her without first obtaining her permission, and he promised never to return. He had mailed it without thinking, and when he did have second thoughts, it was too late to retrieve it. But he did not believe so many explanations were necessary, and he simply asked Fermina Dasa please not to read the letter. "Of course," she said. "After all, letters belong to the person who writes them. Don't you agree?" He made a bold move.
"I do," he said. "That is why they are the first things returned when an affair is ended."
She ignored his hidden intentions and returned the letter to him, saying,
"It is a shame that I cannot read it, because the others have helped me a great deal." He took a deep breath, astounded that she had said so much more than he had hoped for in so spontaneous a manner, and he said,
"You cannot imagine how happy I am to know that."
But she changed the subject, and he could not manage to bring it up again for the rest of the afternoon. He left well after 6 o'clock, as they were beginning to turn on the lights in the house. He felt more secure, but did not have many illusions, because he could not forget Fermina Dasa's fickle character and unpredictable reactions at the age of 20, and he had no reason to think that she had changed. Therefore he risked asking, with sincere humility, if he might return another day, and once again her reply took him by surprise.
"Come back whenever you like," she said. "I am almost always alone."
4 days later, on Tuesday, he returned unannounced, and she did not wait for the tea to be served to tell him how much his letters had helped her. He said that they were not letters in the strict sense of the word, but pages from a book that he would like to write. She, too, had understood them in that way. In fact, she had intended to return them if he would not take that as an insult so that they could be put to better use. She continued speaking of how they had helped her during this difficult time with so much enthusiasm, so much gratitude, perhaps with so much affection, that Florentino Ariza risked something more than a bold move. It was a somersault.
"We called each other tú before," he said.
It was a forbidden word.
Before.
She felt the chimerical angel of the past flying overhead, and she tried to elude it. But he went even further.
"Before, I mean, in our letters."
She was annoyed, and she had to make a serious effort to conceal it. But he knew, and he realized that he had to move with more tact, although the blunder showed him that her temper was still as short as it had been in her youth, although she had learned to soften it.
"I mean," he said, "that these letters are something very different."
"Everything in the world has changed," she said.
"I have not," he said.
"Have you?" She sat with her second cup of tea halfway to her mouth and rebuked him with eyes that had survived so many inclemencies. "By now it does not matter," she said. "I have just turned 72. Florentino Ariza felt the blow in the very center of his heart. He would have liked to find a reply as rapid and well-aimed as an arrow, but the burden of his age defeated him. He had never been so exhausted by so brief a conversation. He felt pain in his heart, and each beat echoed with a metallic resonance in his arteries. He felt old, forlorn, useless, and his desire to cry was so urgent that he could not speak. They finished their second cup in a silence furrowed by presentiments, and when she spoke again it was to ask a maid to bring her the folder of letters. He was on the verge of asking her to keep them for herself, since he had made carbon copies, but he thought this precaution would seem ignoble. There was nothing else to say. Before he left, he suggested coming back on the following Tuesday at the same time. She asked herself whether she should be so acquiescent. "I don't see what sense so many visits would make," she said.
"I hadn't thought they made any sense," he said.
And so he returned on Tuesday at 5 o'clock, and then every Tuesday after that, and he ignored the convention of notifying her, because by the end of the second month the weekly visits had been incorporated into both their routines. Florentino Ariza brought English biscuits for tea, candied chestnuts, Greek olives, little salon delicacies that he would find on the ocean liners. One Tuesday he brought her a copy of the picture of her and Ildebranda, taken by the Belgian photographer more than half a century before, which he had bought for 15 centavos at a postcard sale in the Arcade of the Scribes. Fermina Daza could not understand how it had come to be there, and he could only understand it as a miracle of love. One morning, as he was cutting roses in his garden, Florentino Ariza could not resist the temptation of taking one to her on his next visit. It was a difficult problem in the language of flowers, because she was a recent widow. A red rose, symbol of flaming passion, might offend her mourning. Yellow roses, which in another language were the flowers of good fortune, were an expression of jealousy in the common vocabulary. He had heard of the black roses of Turkey, which were perhaps the most appropriate, but he had not been able to obtain any for acclimatization in his patio. After much thought, he risked a white rose, which he liked less than the others because it was insipid and mute. It did not say anything. At the last minute, in case Fermina Daza was suspicious enough to attribute some meaning to it, he removed the thorns. It was well received as a gift with no hidden intentions, and the Tuesday ritual was enriched, so that when he would arrive with the white rose, the vase filled with water was ready in the center of the tea table. One Tuesday, as he placed the rose in the vase, he said in an apparently casual manner,
"In our day it was camellias, not roses."
"That is true," she said, "but the intention was different, and you know it."
That is how it always was. He would attempt to move forward, and she would block the way. But on this occasion, despite her ready answer, Florentino Ariza realized that he had hit the mark, because she had to turn her face so that he would not see her blush. A burning, childish blush, with a life of its own and an insolence that turned her vexation on herself. Florentino Ariza was very careful to move to other, less offensive topics, but his courtesy was so obvious that she knew she had been found out, and that increased her anger. It was an evil Tuesday. She was on the point of asking him not to return, but the idea of a lover's quarrel seemed so ridiculous at their age and in their circumstances that it provoked a fit of laughter. The following Tuesday, when Florentino Ariza was placing the rose in the vase, she examined her conscience and discovered to her joy that not a vestige of resentment was left over from the previous week. His visits soon began to acquire an awkward familial amplitude, for Dr. Urbino Daza and his wife would sometimes appear as if by accident, and they would stay to play cards. Florentino Ariza did not know how to play, but Fermina taught him in just one visit, and they both sent a written challenge to the Urbino Dazas for the following Tuesday. The games were so pleasant for everyone that they soon became as official as his visits, and patterns were established for each person's contribution. Dr. Urbino and his wife, who was an excellent confectioner, brought exquisite pastries, a different one each time. Florentino Ariza continued to bring delicacies from the European ships, and Fermina Daza found a way to contribute a new surprise each time. They played on the third Tuesday of every month, and although they did not wager with money, the loser was obliged to contribute something special to the next game. There was no difference between Dr. Urbino Daza and his public image. His talents were limited, his manner awkward, and he suffered from sudden twitching, caused by either happiness or annoyance, and from inopportune blushing, which made one fear for his mental fortitude. But it was evident on first meeting him that he was, beyond the shadow of a doubt, what Florentino Ariza most feared people would call him, a good man. His wife, on the other hand, was vivacious, and had a plebeian spark of sharp wit that gave a more human note to her elegance. One could not wish for a better couple to play cards with, and Florentino Ariza's insatiable need for love overflowed with the illusion of feeling that he was part of a family. One night, as they were leaving the house together, Dr. Urbino Daza asked him to have lunch with him. "Tomorrow, at 12:30 at the social club." It was an exquisite dish, served with a poisonous wine. The social club reserved the right to refuse admission for any number of reasons, and one of the most important was illegitimate birth. Uncle Leo XII had experienced great annoyance in this regard, and Florentino Ariza himself had suffered the humiliation of being asked to leave when he was already sitting at the table as the guest of one of the founding members, for whom Florentino Ariza had performed complex favors in the area of river commerce, and who had no other choice but to take him elsewhere to eat. "Those of us who make the rules have the greatest obligation to abide by them," he had said to him. Nevertheless, Florentino Ariza took the risk with Dr. Urbino Daza, and he was welcomed with special deference, although he was not asked to sign the gold book for notable guests. The lunch was brief. There were just the two of them, and its tone was subdued. The fears regarding the meeting that had troubled Florentino Ariza since the previous afternoon vanished with the port he had as an aperitif. Dr. Urbino Daza wanted to talk to him about his mother. Because of everything that he said, Florentino Ariza realized that she had spoken to her son about him. And something still more surprising, she had lied on his behalf. She told him that they had been childhood friends, playmates from the time of her arrival from San Juan de la Cienega,
and that he had introduced her to reading, for which she was forever grateful. She also told him that after school she had often spent long hours in the notions shop with Tránsito Ariza, performing prodigious feats of embroidery, for she had been a notable teacher, and that if she had not continued seeing Florentino Ariza with the same frequency, it had not been through choice, but because of how their lives had diverged. Before he came to the heart of his intentions, Dr. Urbino Daza made several digressions on the subject of aging. He thought that the world would make more rapid progress without the burden of old people. He said,
"Humanity, like armies in the field, advances at the speed of the slowest."
He foresaw a more humanitarian, and by the same token, a more civilized future in which men and women would be isolated in marginal cities when they could no longer take care of themselves, so that they might be spared the humiliation, suffering, and frightful loneliness of old age. From the medical point of view, according to him, the proper age limit would be 70. But until they reached that degree of charity, the only solution was nursing homes, where the old could console each other and share their likes and dislikes, their habits and sorrows, safe from their natural disagreements with the younger generation. He said,
"Old people, with other old people, are not so old."
Well then, Dr. Urbino Daza wanted to thank Florentino Ariza for the good companionship he gave his mother in the solitude of her widowhood. He begged him to continue doing so for the good of them both and the convenience of all, and to have patience with her senile whims. Florentino Ariza was relieved with the outcome of their interview.
"Don't worry," he said. "I am now 4 years older than she is, and have been since long, long before you were born."
Then he succumbed to the temptation of giving vent to his feelings with an ironic barb.
"In the society of the future," he concluded, "you would have to visit the cemetery now to bring her and me a bouquet of arum lilies for lunch."
Until that moment, Dr. Urbino Daza had not noticed the inappropriateness of his prognostications, and he became enmeshed in a long series of explanations that only made matters worse. But Florentino Ariza helped him to extricate himself. He was radiant, for he knew that sooner or later he was going to have another meeting like this one with Dr. Urbino Daza, in order to satisfy an unavoidable social convention, the formal request for his mother's hand in marriage. The lunch had been very encouraging, not only in and of itself, but because it showed him how simple and well-received that inexorable request was going to be. If he could have counted on Fermina Daza's consent, no occasion would have been more propitious. Moreover, after their conversation at this historic lunch, the formality of a request was almost de trop. Even in his youth, Florentino Ariza climbed up and down stairs with special care, for he had always believed that old age began with one's first minor fall and that death came with the second. The staircase in his offices seemed the most dangerous of all to him because it was so steep and narrow, and long before he had to make a special effort not to drag his feet, he would climb it with his eyes fixed on each step and both hands clutching the banister. It had often been suggested that he replace it with one that was less dangerous, but he always put off the decision until next month because he thought it was a concession to old age. As the years passed, it took him longer and longer to walk up the stairs, not because it was harder for him, as he himself hurried to explain, but because he used greater and greater care in the climb. Nevertheless, on the afternoon when he returned from lunch with Dr. Urbino Daza, after the aperitif of port and half a glass of red wine with the meal, and above all, after their triumphal conversation, he tried to reach the third stair with so youthful a dance step that he twisted his left ankle, fell backward, and only by a miracle did not kill himself. As he was falling, he had enough lucidity to think that he was not going to die of this accident, because the logic of life would not allow two men who had loved the same woman so much for so many years to die in the same way within a year of each other. He was right. He was put into a plaster cast from his foot to his calf and forced to remain immobile in bed. But he was livelier than he had been before his fall. When the doctor ordered 60 days of convalescence, he could not believe his misfortune.
"Don't do this to me, doctor," he begged. "2 months for me are like 10 years for you."
He tried to get up several times, holding his leg that was like a statue's with both hands, and reality always defeated him. But when at last he walked again, his ankle still painful and his back raw, he had more than enough reasons to believe that destiny had rewarded his perseverance with a providential fall. The first Monday was his worst day. The pain had eased, and the medical prognosis was very encouraging, but he refused to accept the fatality of not seeing Fermina Daza the following afternoon for the first time in 4 months. Nevertheless, after a resigned siesta, he submitted to reality and wrote her a note excusing himself. He wrote it by hand on perfumed paper and in luminous ink so that it could be read in the dark, and with no sense of shame, he dramatized the gravity of his accident in an effort to arouse her compassion. She answered him 2 days later, very sympathetic, very kind, without one word extra, just as in the great days of their love. He seized the opportunity as it flew by and wrote to her again. When she answered a second time, he decided to go much further than in their coded Tuesday conversations, and he had a telephone installed next to his bed on the pretext of keeping an eye on the company's daily affairs. He asked the operator to connect him with a 3-digit number that he had known by heart since the first time he dialed it. The quiet voice strained by the mystery of distance. The beloved voice answered, recognized the other voice, and said goodbye after 3 conventional phrases of greeting. Florentino Ariza was devastated by her indifference. They were back at the beginning. 2 days later, however, he received a letter from Fermina Daza in which she begged him not to call again. Her reasons were valid. There were so few telephones in the city that all communication took place through an operator who knew all the subscribers, their lives, their miracles, and it did not matter if they were not at home, she would find them wherever they might be. In return for such efficiency, she kept herself informed of their conversations. She uncovered the secrets, the best-kept dramas of their private lives, and it was not unusual for her to interrupt a conversation in order to express her point of view or to calm tempers. Then, too, that year marked the founding of Justice, an evening newspaper whose sole purpose was to attack the families with long last names, inherited and unencumbered names, which was the publisher's revenge because his sons had not been admitted to the social club. Despite her unimpeachable life, Fermina Daza was more careful now than ever of everything she said or did, even with her closest friends, so that she maintained her connection to Florentino Ariza by means of the anachronistic thread of letters. The correspondence back and forth became so frequent and intense that he forgot about his leg and the chastisement of the bed, he forgot about everything, and he dedicated himself totally to writing on the kind of portable table used in hospitals to serve meals to patients. They called each other tú again. Again they exchanged commentaries on their lives, as they had done once before in their letters, and again Florentino Ariza tried to move too quickly. He wrote her name with the point of a pin on the petals of a camellia and sent it to her in a letter. 2 days later, it was returned with no message. Fermina Daza could not help it. All that seemed like children's games to her, most of all when Florentino Ariza insisted on evoking the afternoons of melancholy verses in the Park of the Evangels, the letters hidden along her route to school, the embroidery lessons under the almond trees. With sorrowing heart, she reprimanded him in what appeared to be a casual question in the midst of other trivial remarks. "Why do you insist on talking about what does not exist?" Later, she reproached him for his fruitless insistence on not permitting himself to grow old in a natural way. This was, according to her, the reason for his haste and constant blundering as he evoked the past. She could not understand how a man capable of the thoughts that had given her the strength to endure her widowhood could become entangled in so childish a manner when he attempted to apply them to his own life. Their roles were reversed. Now it was she who tried to give him new courage to face the future, with a phrase that he, in his reckless haste, could not decipher. Let time pass, and we will see what it brings. For he was never as good a student as she was. His forced immobility, the growing lucidity of his conviction that time was fleeting, his mad desire to see her, everything proved to him that his fear of falling had been more accurate and more tragic than he had foreseen. For the first time, he began to think in a reasoned way about the reality of death. Leona Cassiani helped him to bathe and to change his pajamas every other day. She gave him his enemas, she held a portable urinal for him, she applied arnica compresses to the bedsores on his back. She gave him the massages recommended by the doctor so that his immobility would not cause other, more severe ailments. On Saturdays and Sundays, she was relieved by America Vicuña, who was to receive her teaching degree in December of that year. He had promised to send her to Alabama for further study at the expense of the River Company, in part to quiet his conscience, and above all, in order not to face either the reproaches that she did not know how to make to him, or the explanations that he owed to her. He never imagined how much she suffered during her sleepless nights at school, during the weekends without him, during her life without him, because he never imagined how much she loved him. He had been informed in an official letter from the school that she had fallen from her perpetual first place in the class to last, and that she had almost failed her final examinations. But he ignored his duty as guardian. He said nothing to America Vicuña's parents, restrained by a sense of guilt that he tried to elude, and he did not discuss it with her because of a well-founded fear that she would try to implicate him in her failure. And so he left things as they were. Without realizing it, he was beginning to defer his problems in the hope that death would resolve them. The two women who took care of him, and Florentino Ariza himself, were surprised at how much he had changed. Less than 10 years before, he had assaulted one of the maids behind the main staircase in the house, dressed and standing as she was, and in less time than a Filipino rooster he had left her in a family way. He had to give her a furnished house in exchange for her swearing that the author of her dishonor was a part-time Sunday sweetheart who had never even kissed her, and her father and uncles, who were proficient sugarcane cutters, forced them to marry. It did not seem possible that this could be the same man. This man handled front and back by two women who just a few months earlier had made him tremble with love, and who now soaped him above his waist and below, dried him with towels of Egyptian cotton, and massaged his entire body, while he did not emit a single sigh of passion. Each of them had a different explanation for his lack of desire. Leona Cassiani thought it was the prelude to death. America Vicuña attributed it to a hidden cause, whose intricacies she could not decipher. He alone knew the truth, and it had its own name. In any case, it was unfair. They suffered more in serving him than he did in being so well served. Fermina Daza needed no more than 3 Tuesdays to realize how much she missed Florentino Ariza's visits. She enjoyed the friends who were frequent visitors, and she enjoyed them even more as time distanced her from her husband's habits. Lucrecia del Real del Obispo had gone to Panama to have her ear examined because of a pain that nothing could ease, and after a month she came back feeling much better, but hearing less than she had before, and using an ear trumpet. Fermina Daza was the friend who was most tolerant of her confusions of questions and answers, and this was so encouraging to Lucrecia that hardly a day went by that she did not stop in at any hour. But for Fermina Daza, no one could take the place of her calming afternoons with Florentino Ariza. The memory of the past did not redeem the future, as he insisted on believing. On the contrary, it strengthened the conviction that Fermina Daza had always had. That the feverish excitement of 20 had been something very noble, very beautiful, but it had not been love. Despite her rough honesty, she did not intend to disclose that to him, either by mail or in person, nor did she have it in her heart to tell him how false the sentimentalities of his letters sounded after the miraculous consolation of his written meditations, how his lyrical lies cheapened him, how detrimental his maniacal insistence on recapturing the past was to his cause. No, not one line of his letters of long ago, not a single moment of her own despised youth, had made her feel that Tuesday afternoons without him could be as tedious, as lonely, and as repetitious as they really were. In one of her attacks of simplification, she had relegated to the stables the radio console that her husband had given her as an anniversary gift, and which both of them had intended to present to the museum as the first in the city. In the gloom of her mourning, she had resolved not to use it again. For a widow bearing her family names could not listen to any kind of music without offending the memory of the dead, even if she did so in private. But after her third solitary Tuesday, she had it brought back to the drawing room, not to enjoy the sentimental song on the Riobamba station, as she had done before, but to fill her idle hours with the soap operas from Santiago de Cuba. It was a good idea, for after the birth of her daughter, she had begun to lose the habit of reading that her husband had inculcated with so much diligence ever since their honeymoon, and with the progressive fatigue of her eyes, she had stopped altogether, so that months would go by without her knowing where she had left her reading glasses. She took such a liking to the soap operas from Santiago de Cuba that she waited with impatience for each day's new episode. From time to time, she listened to the news to find out what was going on in the world, and on the few occasions when she was alone in the house, she would turn the volume very low and listen to distant, clear merengues from Santo Domingo and plenas from Puerto Rico. One night, on an unknown station that suddenly came in as strong and clear as if it were next door, she heard heartbreaking news. An elderly couple, who for 40 years had been repeating their honeymoon every year in the same spot, had been murdered, bludgeoned to death with oars by the skipper of the boat they were riding in, who then robbed them of all the money they were carrying, $14. The effect on her was even more devastating when Lucrecia del Real told her the complete story, which had been published in a local newspaper. The police had discovered that the elderly couple beaten to death were clandestine lovers who had taken their vacations together for 40 years, but who each had a stable and happy marriage as well as very large families. Fermina Daza, who never cried over the soap operas on the radio, had to hold back the knot of tears that choked her. In his next letter, without any comment, Florentino Ariza sent her the news item that he had cut out of the paper. These were not the last tears that Fermina Daza was going to hold back. Florentino Ariza had not yet finished his 60 days of seclusion when Justice published a front-page story, complete with photographs of the two protagonists, about the alleged secret love affair between Dr. Juvenal Urbino and Lucrecia del Real del Obispo. There was speculation on the details of their relationship, the frequency of their meetings and how they were arranged, and the complicity of her husband, who was given to excesses of sodomy with the blacks on his sugar plantation. The story, published in enormous block letters in an ink the color of blood, fell like a thundering cataclysm on the enfeebled local aristocracy. Not a line of it was true. Juvenal Urbino and Lucrecia del Real had been close friends in the days when they were both single, and they had continued their friendship after their marriages, but they had never been lovers. In any case, it did not seem that the purpose of the story was to sully the name of Dr. Juvenal Urbino, whose memory enjoyed universal respect, But to injure the husband of Lucrecia del Real, who had been elected president of the social club the week before. The scandalous story was suppressed in a few hours. But Lucrecia del Real did not visit Fermina Daza again, and Fermina Daza interpreted this as a confession of guilt. It was soon obvious, however, that Fermina Daza was not immune to the hazards of her class. Justice attacked her one weak flank, her father's business. When he was forced into exile, she knew of only one instance of his shady dealings, which had been told to her by Gala Placidia. Later, when Dr. Urbino confirmed the story after his interview with the governor, she was convinced that her father had been the victim of slander. The facts were that two government agents had come to the house on the Park of the Evangels with a warrant, searched it from top to bottom without finding what they were looking for, and at last ordered the wardrobe with the mirrored doors in Fermina Daza's old bedroom to be opened. Gala Placidia, who was alone in the house and lacked the means to stop anyone from doing anything, refused to open it, with the excuse that she did not have the keys. Then one of the agents broke the mirror on the door with the butt of his revolver and found the space between the glass and the wood stuffed with counterfeit $100 bills. This was the last in a chain of clues that led to Lorenzo Daza as the final link in a vast international operation. It was a masterful fraud, for the bills had the watermarks of the original paper. $1 bills had been erased by a chemical process that seemed to be magic and reprinted as $100 notes. Lorenzo Daza claimed that the wardrobe had been purchased long after his daughter's wedding, and that it must have come into the house with the bills already in it. But the police proved that it had been there since the days when Fermina Daza had been in school. He was the only one who could have hidden the counterfeit fortune behind the mirrors. This was all Dr. Urbino told his wife when he promised the governor that he would send his father-in-law back to his own country in order to cover up the scandal. But the newspaper told much more. It said that during one of the many civil wars of the last century, Lorenzo Daza had been the intermediary between the government of the liberal president Aquileo Parra and one Joseph T.K. Korzeniowski, a native of Poland and a member of the crew of the merchant ship San Antoine, sailing under the French flag, who had spent several months here trying to conclude a complicated arms deal. Korzeniowski, who later became famous as Joseph Conrad, made contact somehow with Lorenzo Daza, who bought the shipment of arms from him on behalf of the government with his credentials and his receipts in order and the purchase price in gold. According to the story in the newspaper, Lorenzo Daza claimed that the arms had been stolen in an improbable raid, and then he sold them again for twice their value to the conservatives who were at war with the government. Justice also said that at the time that General Rafael Reyes founded the Navy, Lorenzo Daza bought a shipment of surplus boots at a very low price from the English army, and with that one deal, he doubled his fortune in 6 months. According to the newspaper, when the shipment reached this port, Lorenzo Daza refused to accept it because it contained only boots for the right foot. But he was the sole bidder when customs auctioned it according to the law, and he bought it for the token sum of 100 pesos. At the same time, under similar circumstances, an accomplice purchased the shipment of boots for the left foot that had reached Riohacha. Once they were in pairs, Lorenzo Daza took advantage of his relationship by marriage to the Urbino de la Calle family and sold the boots to the new Navy at a profit of 2,000%. The story in Justice concluded by saying that Lorenzo Daza did not leave San Juan de la Cienega at the end of the last century in search of better opportunities for his daughter's future, as he liked to say. But because he had been found out in his prosperous business of adulterating imported tobacco with shredded paper, which he did with so much skill that not even the most sophisticated smokers noticed the deception. They also uncovered his links to a clandestine international enterprise, whose most profitable business at the end of the last century had been the illegal smuggling of Chinese from Panama. On the other hand, his suspect mule trading which had done so much harm to his reputation, seemed to be the only honest business he had ever engaged in. When Florentino Ariza left his bed, with his back on fire and carrying a walking stick for the first time instead of his umbrella, his first excursion was to Fermina Daza's house. She was like a stranger, ravaged by age, whose resentment had destroyed her desire to live. Dr. Urbino Daza, in the two visits he had made to Florentino Ariza during his exile, had spoken to him of how disturbed his mother was by the two stories in Justice. The first provoked her to such irrational anger at her husband's infidelity and her friend's disloyalty that she renounced the custom of visiting the family mausoleum one Sunday each month, for it infuriated her that he, inside his coffin, could not hear the insults she wanted to shout at him. She had a quarrel with a dead man. She let Lucrecia del Real know, through anyone who would repeat it to her, that she should take comfort in having had at least one real man in the crowd of people who had passed through her bed. As for the story about Lorenzo Daza, there was no way to know which affected her more, the story itself or her belated discovery of her father's true character. But one or the other, or both, had annihilated her. Her hair, the color of stainless steel, had ennobled her face, but now it looked like ragged yellow strands of corn silk, and her beautiful panther eyes did not recover their old sparkle, even in the brilliant heat of her anger. Her decision not to go on living was evident in every gesture. She had long ago given up smoking, whether locked in the bathroom or anywhere else, but she took it up again, for the first time in public, and with an uncontrolled voracity. At first with cigarettes she rolled herself, as she had always liked to do, and then with ordinary ones sold in stores, because she no longer had time or patience to do it herself. Anyone else would have asked himself what the future could hold for a lame old man whose back burned with a burro's saddle sores and a woman who longed for no other happiness but death. But not Florentino Ariza. He found a glimmer of hope in the ruins of disaster, for it seemed to him that Fermina Daza's misfortune glorified her, that her anger beautified her, and that her rancor with the world had given her back the untamed character she had displayed at the age of 20. She had new reasons for being grateful to Florentino Ariza, because in response to the infamous stories, he had written Justice an exemplary letter concerning the ethical responsibilities of the press and respect for other people's honor. They did not publish it, but the author sent a copy to the Commercial Daily, the oldest and most serious newspaper along the Caribbean coast, which featured the letter on the front page. Signed with the pseudonym Jupiter, it was so reasoned, incisive, and well-written that it was attributed to some of the most notable writers in the province. It was a lone voice in the middle of the ocean, but it was heard at great depth and great distance. Fermina Daza knew who the author was without having to be told, because she recognized some of the ideas and even a sentence taken directly from Florentino Ariza's moral reflections. And so she received him with renewed affection in the disarray of her solitude. It was at this time that America Vicuña found herself alone one Saturday afternoon in the bedroom on the Street of Windows, and without looking for them, by sheer accident, she found the typed copies of the Meditations of Florentino Ariza and the handwritten letters of Fermina Daza in a wardrobe without a key. Dr. Urbino Daza was happy about the resumption of the visits that gave so much encouragement to his mother. But Ofelia, his sister, came from New Orleans on the first fruit boat as soon as she heard that Fermina Daza had a strange friendship with a man whose moral qualifications were not the best. Her alarm grew to critical proportions during the first week, when she became aware of the familiarity and self-possession with which Florentino Ariza came into the house, and the whispers and fleeting lovers' quarrels that filled their visits until all hours of the night. What for Dr. Urbino Daza was a healthy affection between two lonely old people was for her a vice-ridden form of secret concubinage. Ofelia Urbino had always been like that, resembling Doña Blanca, her paternal grandmother, more than if she had been her daughter. Like her, she was distinguished. Like her, she was arrogant. And like her, she lived at the mercy of her prejudices. Even at the age of 5, she had been incapable of imagining an innocent friendship between a man and a woman, least of all when they were 80 years old. In a bitter argument with her brother, she said that all Florentino Ariza needed to do to complete his consolation of their mother was to climb into her widow's bed. Dr. Urbino Daza did not have the courage to face her. He had never had the courage to face her. But his wife intervened with a serene justification of love at any age. Ofelia lost her temper.
"Love is ridiculous at our age," she shouted, "but at theirs it is revolting."
She insisted with so much vehemence on her determination to drive Florentino Ariza out of the house that it reached Fermina Daza's ears. She called her to her bedroom, as she always did when she wanted to talk without being heard by the servants, and she asked her to repeat her accusations. Ofelia did not soften them. She was certain that Florentino Ariza, whose reputation as a pervert was known to everyone, was carrying on an equivocal relationship that did more harm to the family's good name than the villainies of Lorenzo Daza or the ingenious adventures of Juvenal Urbino. Fermina Daza listened to her without saying a word, without even blinking. But when she finished, Fermina Daza was another person. She had come back to life.
"The only thing that hurts me is that I do not have the strength to give you the beating you deserve for being insolent and evil-minded," she said. "But you will leave this house right now. And I swear to you on my mother's grave that you will not set foot in it again as long as I live."
There was no power that could dissuade her. Ofelia went to live in her brother's house, and from there she sent all kinds of petitions with distinguished emissaries. But it was in vain. Neither the mediation of her son nor the intervention of her friends could break Fermina Daza's resolve. At last, in the colorful language of her better days, she allowed herself to confide in her daughter-in-law, with whom she had always maintained a certain plebeian camaraderie.
"A century ago, life screwed that poor man and me because we were too young. And now they want to do the same thing because we are too old."
She lit a cigarette with the end of the one she was smoking, and then she gave vent to all the poison that was gnawing at her insides.
"They can all go to hell," she said. "If we widows have any advantage, it is that there is no one left to give us orders."
There was nothing to be done. When at last she was convinced that she had no more options, Ofelia returned to New Orleans. After much pleading, her mother would only agree to say goodbye to her, but she would not allow her in the house. She had sworn on her mother's grave, and for her, during those dark days, that was the only thing left that was still pure. On one of his early visits, when he was talking about his ships, Florentino Ariza had given Fermina Daza a formal invitation to take a pleasure cruise along the river. With one more day of traveling by train, she could visit the national capital, which they, like most Caribbeans of their generation, still called by the name it bore until the last century, Santa Fe. But she maintained the prejudices of her husband, and she did not want to visit a cold, dismal city where the women did not leave their houses except to attend 5 o'clock mass, and where, she had been told, they could not enter ice cream parlors or public offices, and where the funerals disrupted traffic at all hours of the day or night, and where it had been drizzling since the year 1, worse than in Paris. On the other hand, she felt a very strong attraction to the river. She wanted to see the alligators sunning themselves on the sandy banks. She wanted to be awakened in the middle of the night by the woman's cry of the manatees. But the idea of so arduous a journey at her age, and a lone widow besides, seemed unrealistic to her. Florentino Ariza repeated the invitation later on, when she had decided to go on living without her husband, and then it had seemed more plausible. But after her quarrel with her daughter, embittered by the insults to her father, by her rancor toward her dead husband, by her anger at the hypocritical duplicities of Lucrecia del Real, whom she had considered her best friend for so many years, she felt herself superfluous in her own house. One afternoon, while she was drinking her infusion of worldwide leaves, she looked toward the morass of the patio where the tree of her misfortune would never bloom again. "What I would like is to walk out of this house and keep going, 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 and never come back," she said.
"Take a boat," said Florentino Ariza.
Fermina Daza looked at him thoughtfully. "Well, I might just do that," she said. A moment before she said it, the thought had not even occurred to her. But all she had to do was admit the possibility for it to be considered a reality. Her son and daughter-in-law were delighted when they heard the news. Florentino Ariza hastened to point out that on his vessels, Fermina Daza would be a guest of honor. She would have a cabin to herself which would be just like home. She would enjoy perfect service, and the captain himself would attend to her safety and well-being. He brought route maps to encourage her, picture postcards of furious sunsets, poems to the primitive paradise of the Magdalena written by illustrious travelers and by those who had become travelers by virtue of the poems. She would glance at them when she was in the mood. "You do not have to cajole me as if I were a baby," she told him. "If I go, it will be because I have decided to, and not because the landscape is interesting." When her son suggested that his wife accompany her, she cut him off abruptly. "I am too big to have anyone take care of me." She herself arranged the details of the trip. She felt immense relief.